This is Mae Brussel. It is the second half of World Watchers, the program number 811. And I want to continue with this article from In These Times by Vince Valesky and Dennis Bernstein, because it is very, very important with the hearings going on now to understand the current behind the hearings and the conflicts of interest that are taking place. To continue about Thomas Polgar of the Central Intelligence Agency, he's been active in a firm called Ackerman and Palumbo, Incorporated in Miami, and it's made up of former CIA officers. One is Mike Ackerman. He was 11 years with the CIA covert operations, and the other is Louis Palumbo, and he became a partner with Ackerman in 1977. And they provide Fortune 500 with information on counterterrorism and security training and kidnap retrieval of executives. And they had a company in Nicaragua until 1979. Evidently, the company wasn't very good at advising because they fled and left when Somoza left in 1979. And Thomas Polgar was and is a paid consultant to that firm. So while he works with persons, Contras, who state openly that they want to overthrow the government of Nicaragua, he is looking into people who are illegally, who were illegally, planning excuses to invade Nicaragua by even killing a very conservative American U.S. ambassador. Now, Polgar wrote in the Miami Herald, December the 14th, 1986, an article titled Decent Men Outside the Law, and it was a tribute to Eugene Hassenfuss, who had landed in Nicaragua in October of 86, and he said that these are patriotic people, and he praised Mr. Hassenfuss, and then he said, the CIA wasn't involved. These were private individuals. They weren't involved in the flight. It was run by people no longer in government, former CIA types. And again, he's hiding the CIA just as he did in Saigon, and that's why he's hired by Senator Inouye and the commission at the present time. Another conflict, a gross conflict, of course, with Polgar, is covering up the murders in Costa Rica of seven journalists and the near murder of other people, including Eden Pastora, LaPinka bombing, the subject of the Christic Institute suit. There is strong evidence, according to the persons of the Christic Institute, that a man named Per Anker Hansen, who goes by the, his other name is Amak Galil, is actually a Libyan who set up the bombing, and he was recruited from the Chilean secret police. Now, David Atlee Phillips was down there with the Chile police. Salvador Allende was murdered, and Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins were down there. They would have a lot of reason and access to get Chilean members of DINA, the police there, to set off this engin provocateur activity with the chance of invading Nicaragua, kicking out the Sandinistas. This article says that John Hull, who was behind the killings, and also a man named David, was killed on the grounds of his property. Hull is a former CIA operative, along with Thomas Polgar and the others, and he was seen traveling in Costa Rica at the border with this man, Mr. Hansen-Galil, and Alberto Guevara has said under oath that he saw John Hull and Mr. Hansen-Galil in preparation of the bombing, getting ready to do it, and they were involved. Now, Polgar went to Costa Rica, and this lawsuit was filed a year ago. He had every reason to investigate the role that drugs would have in the Iran-Contra affair, in assassinations, murders, or planned coups. But there was a conflict of interest, again, because he was sent down there to protect the Central Intelligence Agency, and about 400 agents left in 1975, and he's a member of the group that continues to lobby Congress, and when they're found doing anything wrong, they cover it up. So the perfect place to send Mr. Thomas Polgar was down to Costa Rica, and that's why people are waiting to hear the parts of the Iran-Contra affair deal with the drugs, the assassination, and the attempted coup for Nicaragua, and they're not hearing it, ask any of the witnesses, because Polgar arranged for interviews down there. He went to the U.S. Embassy, and he interviewed people that were to his own interest, to give him the kind of information he wanted, and excluded all interviews that would be contrary to what he's supposed to think or ask about. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle had a story June 22nd this morning on a man that lives in Costa Rica, Alfonso Robello. He runs a sugarcane industry. He's a wealthy man. And our American AID gave him $3 million to run this operation. He's a multimillionaire. Rubella received $10,000 a month from Oliver North, even though the AID had given him this $3 million for his sugar plantation in Costa Rica, and he split the money with Fernando Camero, a Contra military leader, and both support the armed overthrow of Nicaragua. So Alfonso Rubella serves his sugar cane industry down there, put into business by the United States, then takes the National Security Council money and works with a former CIA man, Mr. Hall, at his ranch. And he also hires in the sugar plantation business the president of Costa Rica's father and brother. Oscar Arias's father and brother work for Contra leader Alfonso Rubella, and the Americans put him in business and then send him a monthly check, and then he gives it to the military leader of the Contras. So Pulgar went down there and he never interviewed John Hall in Costa Rica. He never interviewed the key witnesses to Hall's Contra military operations, such as Peter Glibbery, a British mercenary in jail. He never contacted the Christic Institute for their information on why they filed the suit. He doesn't want to hear anything about the dates, evidence, or sources of information. And regarding the question of drugs, they asked him, and this article says his answer regarding drugs and Contras, and would he investigate them or find evidence down there, such as the Christic Institute did with the Medellin cartel, the cocaine kings. He said, "Don't you think it would be absurd for a conservative American rancher to smuggle drugs?" Well, think of the mindset of Pulgar in the Central Intelligence 30 years and station chief in Saigon. The admirals and the generals and high officials of the American government, including the CIA director, William Colby, have been linked to the narcotics traffic of Southeast Asia, to the Nguyen Bank, which does connect to General Secord and Oliver North, and they made tremendous profits off the war. The profit of a Porsche is small. What General Secord got, an airplane and a Porsche, is very small compared to the drug profits. And the explanation of not looking into it is that it isn't reasonable, and yet he and his own team from Southeast Asia and from around the world, I'm sure the Mexican drugs had a lot to do with connections to the United States, also the flow into the United States, and he was station chief there. The article concludes, Pulgar worked with Oliver North in the National Security Council on a terrorist unit. So he wouldn't ask him about activity in Costa Rica, even though he works with Oliver North. And the night of the bombing, La Pensa bombing, the CIA station chief in Costa Rica, John Hall, was with Robert Owen. They were together in Costa Rica. And Owen told the House and Senate Investigation Committee that North told him, ordered him to go to Costa Rica. And a few days before the bombing, and he left the next day after the bombing. So Adolfo Calero was on the stand before the huge number of members of the House and the Senate and the legal team. Robert Owen was on the staff and General Secord, and they characterized the Christic Institute as fairy tale and hogwash. So the person of Thomas Pulgar being in charge of these investigations shows how many conflicts of interest cross over and how bad it is. Now, I want to jump now to an article that was in the Miami Herald that is very pertinent to this case and may be developing as time goes on, because while the intelligence community is protected, the investigators don't mind if they ease this old, tired president who's now reading cue cards when he has a personal conversation in Venice. They don't mind easing him out, and they may have to stick with getting Reagan out of office, but that doesn't mean that they're not the same gun-running death squads that they always were, protecting Murder Incorporated in and out the White House and the National Security Council. The news this past week, just a week ago, many of you saw the quotations of Representative Lee Hamilton of Indiana, who said that there probably, or he hints there might be, a chance that they would have to start impeachment proceedings against the President of the United States. The Congress probably will consider impeaching President Reagan if they discover he knew about the diversion of funds. Now, in the past week, they've been saying that Hamilton is so conservative and cautious that they have to take him not lightly or with a grain of salt, but listen to what he's saying. In the past few weeks, you've seen in the newspaper that Ronald Reagan said that he was exempt from the ban of the weapons down to the Contras or transferring the funds from Iran to the Contras that the National Security Council was not beholden to the Bolin Amendment. The most interesting article on that subject that I've seen comes out of the Miami Herald, May the 31st, 1987. That was several weeks ago, by Alfonso Chardy. And incidentally, I think he's writing about the best articles there are on the Iran-Contra affair, coming, as I say, the Miami Herald. This article says, "Directive cast doubt on Reagan's defense. A 1981 order undercuts the Contra aid argument." And this is what Chardy says. "President Reagan in 1981 signed an order designating the National Security Council as the top government entity, coordinating all the other U.S. intelligence activities, apparently contradicting the latest White House legal defense that NSC was not covered by a law prohibiting aid to the Nicaraguan Contras. A House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee in August 16, 1985, sent a letter and reminded the White House of the 1981 designation, which is discussing whether the so-called Bolin Amendment outlawing aid to the Contras applied to the NSC. The designation and the subsequent congressional reminder are certain to figure in the growing debates over the president and his advisors." And the Bolin Amendment went into effect October the 12th, 1984. "Some congressional leaders are leaning to suggest very privately that they may have to consider punishing Reagan for some of his officers or their actions. The congressional leaders scrupulously avoid the word impeachment. However, some acknowledge that the issue of removing Reagan from office has been debated publicly, and one Texas congressman, Henry Gonzalez, quietly filed his resolution March the 5th, 1987, for impeachment proceedings. And these have been given quietly to the Justice Department, the judiciary." And this article compares it to the time of Watergate, when the articles of impeachment were given to Peter Rodino very quietly and were put on the books. "The question of the president's legal responsibility has come to the fore in the last 2 weeks as Reagan and his advisors abandoned the White House claims that they didn't know the extent of the CIA involvement and the White House with the Contras from October 84 to 85. It goes on, "Reagan and his chief of staff, Howard Baker, are not knowing now what to do with the law. They said that the Bolin Amendment doesn't apply to the president, but the one paragraph in the Bolin Amendment was revised several times by Congress, and in the form that it stood from October 12, 85 to September 30, 1985, it barred the administration from spending funds available to the CIA, Pentagon, or any other agency or entity of the United States involved in intelligence activities." Now, here is the catch, a different angle to this story that I haven't seen in other newspapers. Congressional investigators said that the language would appear not only to encompass the NSC, but because on December the 8th, 1981, when Reagan was president just about a year, he gave an executive order signed by himself regulating the intelligence activities. He said the NSC shall act as the highest executive branch entity that provides review, guidance, and direction for the conduct of national foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, and special activities and attendant policies, that the White House would be responsible for those. The White House declined comment last Friday when asked about the 1981 order. A recent White House legal analysis holds that the NSC is neither intelligence agency or governed by the Bolin Amendment, but the documents released by the Congressional Committee show that the National Security Council took on the responsibility for intelligence away from the intelligence agencies into the White House. In a letter dated August 16, 1985, Representative Michael Barnes of Maryland, and he's the one that Spitz Channel made sure that he wasn't reelected into Congress from Maryland, noted that the president and Robert McFarland should remember that they signed this other agreement in 1981, December 81, the 8th, and that he reminded them and National Security Advisor Robert McFarland of what they had signed. And the Barnes letter apparently was the one that caused Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North to hurry and hire Mr. Breton Sciarroni, that stooge that you saw on television testifying about the Bolin Amendment. They quickly got legal advice from the President's Intelligence Oversight Board, because Congressman Barnes said in 1985, remember now what the Boland Amendment says, and in 1981 you took responsibility for the Intelligence Committee, and therefore you are responsible and not separate from it. And this article continues, the legal experts are now discussing the issue. Harvard constitutional law professor Lawrence Tribe wrote a piece in the New York Times in which he advocated impeachment. He said he knows the president's popular, but it is extremely important for those who are serious about the Constitution to be straightforward and not second-guess the political will. The fact is that the impeachable offenses exist, Tribe said. And he said, to the extent that Reagan admits to orchestrating and funding the efforts to channel private and foreign contributions to the Contras, he would have been guilty of serious subversion of the separation of the powers of the Constitution and the statutory limitations of the president and executive branch who conduct government programs, and he's in violation of Congress and control over the power of the purse. So Reagan literally tied his own noose, if this article is correct, by insisting in December 1981 that he would be in charge of all intelligence, then later saying the intelligence is not part of the general intelligence where he actually signed these documents. And it's interesting that Congressman Barnes saw this constitutional question coming up in 1985 and, in all fairness, reminded the White House right there, this is what you're doing and this is what you want to have control of. So they quickly brought in the attorney Sciarrini, who wrote something that they wanted to see, not what pertained to the December 81 transfer of intelligence to the White House, and it locked up his opinion, and so the rest of this is going to be history. Now, as I say, the article has a list of the impeachment resolution that was filed at that time, just recently, by Senator Henry Gonzalez. If you write to him, you can get a copy of this. Some people heard Ray Talfiore on KGO talking about this, and Gonzalez sent them copies of the impeachment that he filed March the 5th, 1987, the impeachment resolution. Tell him you got it from May Brussels World Watchers and send for this. Now, this is what he signed in the resolution, in case you haven't seen it. One, violation of the Arms Export Control Act for the acquiescing to Israel the shipping of U.S. arms to Iran without written authorization. Two, the violation of Foreign Assistance Act, allowing CIA to front a company to ship weapons to Iran without proper intelligence finding. Three, violation of National Security and Arms Export Control Acts for not notifying Congress in a timely manner about the U.S. arms shipments to Iran. Four, violation of the Boland Amendment for having recklessly failed to prevent diversion of profits to Contras from arms sales to Iran. Five, violation of Section 509 of Public Law 99-399 prohibiting arms sales to countries classified as supporting terrorism such as Iran. And six, violation of constitutional duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed for engaging in a pattern of actions in disregard of the law of the United States. And that's the Henry Gonzalez impeachment resolution that he has placed into Congress, and that they're quietly thinking about at this time as matters close in on Ronald Reagan. William Safire had an article just this month called Give the President's Three Blind Mice Some Oversight, and he's talking about the President's Special President's Intelligence Oversight Board that was headed by Charles Myers of the Denver office of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. He's the one who advised Mr. Sciarrini. Interestingly enough, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher is the law firm that represented the Los Angeles Police Department when the police agents were taking material of law-abiding citizens from their computers into Western Goals, where it exists today, and also they have offices in Germany, Vienna, and putting the names of people law-abiding into these computers, a $100,000 one in Los Angeles. And when Larry McDonald was dead, then Carl Spitz Channel took over those files. Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher represented the persons that were doing the shifting of the files that were supposed to be destroyed in 1975 to Carl Spitz Channel. In William Safire's article, this was published June the 12th, he makes a distinction between the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board and the PIOB, which is the President's Intelligence Oversight Board. And he describes this President's Intelligence Advisory Board as not being too efficient at this point. It's headed by Ann Armstrong, Leo Chern, starring, this is his word, starring Henry Kissinger, Jean Kirkpatrick, and Claire Booth Luce. Now, Leo Chern was the fellow from the International Rescue Committee that arranged for the arrival of Lee and Marina Oswald into New York City in June of 1962, following a letter they had sent to John Tower in Texas that Lee Harvey Oswald had sent. And, of course, Henry Kissinger was in charge of Central American policy and Southeast Asian policy over Thomas Polgar, and also the Middle East policies with the Shah of Iran and with the Saudi Arabian countries that became literally our foreign policy, using money from Saudi Arabia for areas that Ronald Reagan wanted to disperse his ideas. So the both committees are hand-in-glove part of the president's operations, and they work with the Dirty Tricks, the secret team. They're part of the secret team. And when Congress warned the president that he may be in danger because he assumed responsibility for the intelligence community after December 81, that they would work inside the NSC, then they brought in an attorney from the Oversight Board to have a dismal written report that he put in a state that nobody could see. Incidentally, I mentioned last week about General Secord speaking at the Bar Association in Texas, and a friend from Houston Post, a friend from Houston, mailed me an article from the Houston Post that there were demonstrations. There were about three dozen lawyers who objected to General Secord speaking to the Bar Association. They said he lied to Congress and he shouldn't be here with the National Lawyers Guild. The vice president of the National Lawyers Guild objected, and they had signs and pickets against him. And while there were 2,000 lawyers present, Secord was paid $7,500 to speak. And one comment was that what qualifies him to speak? Secord isn't a lawyer. His only qualification, as far as we can tell, is he's a defendant. And he is a defendant in the Christic Institute suit. And they said we may as well have had Willie Nelson. We would have had a better choice, that they didn't want Secord there. A lot did protest. And just to remind you of General Secord, I want to repeat just two quotations from him that I shared with you last week, and I may continue to put on the air from time to time. One was in the San Jose Mercury News. General Secord, now we are nearly gridlocked because of hands tied with the CIA covert operations. And it seems to me it's one of those reasons why the White House turned to private sources in the past couple of years to try to do some things they thought were of vital importance that could not be done within the system. And another quotation of Secord from Wall Street Journal, titled "System Has to Be Unlocked," he said, in quotes, "The network's organizers respond that they could act more quickly and objectively than the CIA or the Pentagon. The system has to be unlocked, and I'm not holding my breath until we get a president who's strong enough to do that," said General Secord. And those were the reasons for his operations. Now, going back a few years to Ronald Reagan and the secret team, in July 1981, and this was just 5-6 months before he took the intelligence operation inside the NSC, instead of having them separate entities, I did a broadcast, number 500, for those of you who have the sheets can look it up. I listed there on the sheet that accompanies the broadcast, what do these names have in common with Alexander Haig's terrorist mentality? And I do want to start doing broadcasts on the role of Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger on this entire Iran-Contra affair. And I listed, we should learn from lessons of history from the Bay of Pigs or from World War II, and I listed Theodore Shackley, Edwin Wilson, Frank Newkin, Michael Hand, Frank Turple, Kevin Mulcahy, who was then murdered shortly after that, George Corkula, George Bush, Vernon Walters, William Casey, William Kolb, Michele Sindona, Muhammad Ali Aja, the Wells Fargo Bank, and of course one of those branches now is tied into the Somoza banks and the funneling to Miami of money out of Nicaragua that was used by the Contras for pouring money into the operations of the Saudi Arabian funds. And I also mentioned the Green Beret. And this broadcast, this was 6 years ago, was about terrorism and about counterinsurgency and a book that Theodore Shackley had. And I said, this 6 years ago that they're going to unleash the CIA for bloodbaths in El Salvador, Angola, and elsewhere, that now Ronald Reagan has surfaced and he will be in charge of the CIA. And we have troubles when he starts working with the station chief from Laos and Vietnam in Chile. And I was talking about Theodore Shackley at that time. And I also was quoting an article of Seymour Hersh in the New York Times, June 21st, 1981, about Edwin Wilson, Theodore Shackley, Frank Turple, and the CIA arming and training Gaddafi. Also in 1981, in August, I was talking about the airplane crash of the ex-president of Panama, Mr. Torrijos, and the role of the intelligence community in that. And when Ronald Reagan would be president, we'd have a lot of murders and coups and near murders. And in 1981, there were a long series of them. And I had written in 1973 about Mr. Torrijos and narcotics traffic and the Central Intelligence in Panama. Edwin Wilson was on Larry King this past week. I don't know how many of you saw it. Most of my listeners, if they have television, were probably interested in seeing Edwin Wilson. And I did broadcast going into 1981. I pulled out a few sheets of the bibliography sheets that accompanied the broadcast. One in October 25th, that date, was about the West Coast links of Hewlett-Packard, Stanford Technology, Stanford University Aerospace, to Frank Turple, Edwin Wilson, Theodore Shackley, the defense industry, George Bush, William Casey. And I said, watch this develop. And these were broadcasts about terrorism. I did a lot about these people and their terrorist activities that were visible in 1981. What we call the secret team isn't so secret. And I also did a broadcast in 1983 on the death of important witnesses to the Wilson-Turple case, and Kevin Mulcahy had been blown away by then. He was killed November 82. Rafael Villaverde was killed on his yacht in 1982. Luke Thompson, the former Green Beret who said he feared for his own life in 82. William Russell Cranford, who was shot twice in the head, who worked with the Army Special Forces with Edwin Wilson, and in Ecuador, and Ricardo Morales, who was gunned down in Miami as part of the Wilson-Turple-Shackley-Klein's operation, and Kenneth Duberstein, who was murdered in 1971 from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And the reason those deaths were timely then is that they're timely now, and I don't have time in about 15 or 20 minutes to run down some very important deaths that pertain to the Iran-Contra affair. I'll give you the title of the articles, and I'll do more on them later. One is from the Miami Herald regarding the Stark investigation, May 30th, saying Stark investigation won't divulge findings. And then the Los Angeles Herald Examiner saying, did Iraq behead the pilot who fired on the Stark? If this was an agent provocateur incident, they said there are rumors there apparently embarrassing President Saddam Hussein and that he has been beheaded. In March 1975, there were articles about a young fellow, the nephew of Prince Fouad in Saudi Arabia. He came from Berkeley and Denver, Colorado, and allegedly was on acid, and he killed his uncle, and then the next day he was beheaded. And the controversy at that time was raising the oil prices in the Middle East, which the Shah wanted to do, and Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller wanted to do. And the king of Saudi Arabia, or Crown Prince Fahd, didn't want to do it. He held back, and he was killed, and the person who set this up was beheaded. And I see the similarities between those teams that work in Iran, the agents provocateurs, and the possible beheading of the person who hit the Stark, which gives us the excuse for this huge diversionary that's taking place in the Persian Gulf that could even lead to World War III with Reagan's Armageddon mindset. Now, there have been many articles about the death of Paul Laxalt's sister-in-law. The most interesting I have comes out of the San Francisco Examiner. Mystery death of Paul Laxalt's sister. Napa County in California probes the apparent suicide on the eve of the libel truce. Now, I've said for many, many years that the handpicked presidents of the United States after World War II were to be Richard Nixon, who would follow Eisenhower. And he was vice president there for 8 years, pretty close to Ike with those heart attacks. Then it would be Ronald Reagan, and then it would be Paul Laxalt. And Paul Laxalt had this nasty suit linking him to the Teamsters to Organize Crime, and his sister-in-law was a woman who testified at the trials about the relationships of Paul Laxalt and the family to the crime syndicate and gave testimony in support of the defense. The McClatchy newspapers were defending themselves against a newspaper by against a suit by Paul Laxalt. And one of the main witnesses was found dead in California, and he hopes that with the suit settled, he can become president. Also, a long article in the Los Angeles Times, rather, June the 13th, San Jose Mercury, mysterious death of Iranian arms dealer under investigation, and that's Cyrus Hashimi, and I have a lot on Hashimi's death. I'll share it with you later. Los Angeles Times, May 31st, magazine section, an American contra, the confused life and mysterious death of Stephen Carr. I have a lot more deaths of important witnesses to the Iran-Contra. Time is out now. I can't share them with you. Maybe we'll do this next week. This is Mae Brussel. We'll pick up these pieces and show how when these investigations start, the primary witnesses have been wiped out or will be wiped out. In the meantime, I'll be back with you next week. We'll be listening to the hearings, wearing ourselves out, and save as many articles as you can. This is real history taking place in front of our eyes.